We're recording. You should see it at the top.
It's recording. Okay, yes. Well, welcome to the real life of adults with cerebral palsy with Cindy and Marie. And today we have a guest speaker, David Henney.
Hello.
Before David starts, I'll introduce myself and then Marie will introduce herself because there's a lot of new people on our page at the moment, which is great to see. And then David will tell us about his research and why he's doing it and what he wants to get out of it. So my name is Cindy Evans and I'm from Western Australia, Perth, Western Australia, the most isolated capital city in the world. And I am an exercise scientist, just like David, who lives in America on the other side of the world. And Marie, who also lives in America on the other side of the world, is a person with cerebral palsy. So what we want to do in this podcast, we want to get everybody's perspective, get different perspectives from different people, the people that are practicing in the sector, as well as people with cerebral palsy. So, Marie, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, I'm Marie. Well, CP. Well, CP stands for Workout with Cerebral Palsy. I have quadriplegic cerebral palsy, and I run this group with Cindy, and we're a great mixture of both people that live with CP and then people that work with CP. Today we're welcoming David, who is a PhD recipient for adult cerebral palsy from the
Marie, what's David studying? He's studying how does exercise affect cognition? So like your ability to think.
Okay. Yeah.
What are you working?
Yeah, so I'm currently a PhD candidate, so I'm in the all but dissertation stage of my PhD. So hopefully, barring any major disasters, I will be Dr. Henning by the end of this spring, or I guess fall for you, Cindy. So I'm in the final stages of that. I'm at Michigan State University in their kinesiology department. And within the department, I'm in the cognitive and motor neuroscience concentration. So the group that I'm in, we study the various ways that either disability or other neural factors play into the relationships between physical activity and cognition. So there are groups in the program who study autism and the physical activity, you know, relationships between autism across the spectrum and across ages, various things such as that. So that's where I find myself, you know, looking for my kind of niche, you know, where I'm going to kind of set myself apart. And it was only recently that I learned about, not only just learned about cerebral palsy, but also learned about the real lack of research and lack of representation that exists. And that was really a big motivator.
And when where it exists, where that lack is in the adults, isn't it? You know, because there's quite a big stuff on kids, and especially around
absolutely
the dorsal rhizotomy and stuff like that. But around adults, it's virtually there's nothing out there to find.
Yeah, and that was one of the really striking things for me. A few years into my PhD, after I'd finished my comprehensive exams, I met a master's student who has quadriplegic cerebral palsy named Piotr Pasek. And he wanted to talk about this adaptive sports program that he runs at Michigan State University, where he has multiple adults from throughout the community come in and participate in sports and physical activity and exercise. And so he wanted my input on some of the data he had collected, some help on running statistics, and just through he and I talking, it really opened my eyes to not only living with cerebral palsy in this population, this disability that I really had very little knowledge about.
Can I just tell you a story?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, where I come from, I'm an exercise scientist. I've spent most of my time at university working with elite athletes, and I did run a gym for children that were clumsy, because we were looking at what's the relationship between physical coordination and intelligence, and could, if we got smart kids really coordinated, would that change their levels on their grades and that. Anyway, when I come in from that background, and when I started working with adults with cerebral palsy in London, I didn't know anything about them, so I decided I'd go and find out. And I'd find out what is it, and what do I have to do if I'm going to exercise these guys, because they would look really to anyone I'd done. Do you know, nobody could tell me. I get all these, different things like cerebral palsy is a brain injury, or cerebral palsy causes spasticity. But when you actually ask for how do you do weight training with cerebral palsy, or what sort of exercise is the best stuff to use, actually there just wasn't anything out there at all.
Yeah.
Not find anything out there apart from static stretches, which of course are quite inappropriate.
Right. Yeah. With somebody who has a spasticity doing a static stretches, that's
just not appropriate.
Yeah.
What are static stretches?
That would be like if you were to take your arm and hold it across your body.
Oh, okay.
You're holding a stretch, or you take a joint, hold it, stretch it.
And what happens, of course,
is and then release.
As you stretch something, you continue to keep the force on it. What happens is that the force is being generated, increasing all the time. So for the person with cerebral palsy, which is a force-dependent resistance, the more you do a stretch like that, the more the spasticity comes in and resists you. And you've really got to put a lot of weight on that person to break that spasticity. It's not great. What we should be doing is movement stuff against gravity instead of creating a force and pushing against the person. Yeah, anyway, I just found it like there was nothing out there that said you should be putting your hands near the center, or you should always make sure your hands are in the same place if you're going to put your hands on people, things like that. Don't let the person hold anything because it makes them disabled. But that's not written anywhere.
After working with you for a couple months, I have learned to back off my weights at the gym and go down to lower weights. I know.
Until you can actually use your own body weight, you shouldn't actually be putting extra weights on your body. But it's great to do resistance training if you're doing it in the right way. But that's not what I was talking about. It's like that lack of research. There's literally hundreds of thousands of therapists out there working with people with cerebral palsy and getting paid a great deal of money, and they're not having any guidance on that.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm glad to see that stuff's happening like what David's doing right now. Yeah. So anyway, go back to you, David. So you found that lack of research, which is quite significant.
Right. Yeah. And that was... That has been something that has always kind of motivated me throughout my master's degree and into my PhD as well, has been trying to not only find a field of research that is interesting and exciting, but also just I'm more motivated by questions that haven't been asked yet, or finding solutions to problems. And there's a huge benefit to the field of study that is what we consider like horizontal research, which is taking a known effect or a known relationship and studying that in different populations and with different measurements, but overall just supporting the existing body of knowledge, which is critical. But that isn't something that is directly motivating for me. I'm a lot more motivated by saying, okay, here is some phenomenon, or here is a population, and what do we know about it? What don't we know about it? And if there's questions that have been asked and not answered, or with adults with cerebral palsy, maybe even more importantly, questions that haven't been even asked yet.
And
taking the chance and saying, okay, well, why haven't these questions been asked yet? Or if they have been asked, why haven't they been answered? And what I found was that there was research on adults with cerebral palsy, but it was very limited especially when compared to research in youth with cerebral palsy. And that comes down to a lot of political and sort of very systematic issues with how we deal with healthcare and disability and things like that. But it was very obvious when looking into the research that once an individual with cerebral palsy turns 18, their access to resources, including being a participant in research, almost completely disappears.
I've noticed it even starts at younger age with CP. Like, I remember here, once I stopped growing around like 5th, 7th grade, they...
No more operations.
Yeah, they kind of discharged me from the children's hospital because there was nothing that they could do because I had stopped growing.
I see.
You know, so.
Yeah, and that's such a for me, it was a real disappointment, but at the same time, it was, you know, with me thinking about this career and thinking about these questions that I'm asking and going, wow, look at this. There's like this whole huge like field of research that just hasn't been attempted yet or hasn't been fully like explored. And especially seeing that, you know, it's already a disability population. It's already, you know, population that is being, you know, underserved. And then for that population to go from being children, youths who have direct
a lot
benefits.
Of time around them. Everybody's
right.
Surrounded
yeah.
them.
Right.
And you've got your OT, your physio, your little personal assistant with your classes, and then you finish and it's like, that's it, fella.
Yeah, it's like you're worse than on your own.
Yeah,
and for that to, I mean, there's a certain part for I'm like, okay, well, part of that, you know, kind of is justifiable in that they're an adult and they don't have the same, you know, they have, you know, there's this change into independence and things. But for scientists to go, it is critically valuable and important for us to research children with cerebral palsy. We want to know everything about the child's experience with cerebral palsy. And then for there to be just an immediate drop off when those individuals become adults. So yeah, high school age, and then especially once they hit 18. And it comes down to...
Even at high school, it gets hard because now we're doing this inclusive schooling. It's not like you can't just go to some centre where there's a whole lot of people with cerebral palsy to ask if we can do some research on you. Now everybody's in their individual classrooms, in your individual schools spread across the city, which is great, but it also makes it hard for the researcher because how do you get enough people?
Right.
No, I know this, and then I'm not being biased, but I noticed like a lot of like United Cerebral Palsy when I was growing was a big help. But a couple years ago, it has opened its doors to every kind of disability, and I'm not saying it's wrong or it's right, but there also, I feel like something that helped me as a child is losing focus with what the idea of UCP was. Inviting other disabilities that have nothing to do with Sarah. I understand if they invited people with spina bifida, and because we're kind of under the same umbrella, where, you know, we have the mindset of being, you know, getting
readily intelligent.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because it's only a motor disorder. It's not an intellectual disorder. Now with inclusion and to be able to get the funding dollar, you have to be able to work with a single person. And that's what happened with us at the Cerebral Palsy Society of New Zealand too. Because before that, David, there was a lot of focused research coming from the Cerebral Palsy Societies, you know. I worked for the Cerebral Palsy Society of New Zealand for 14 years. And in that 14 years, they hired at least four different researchers to do different studies on the people, but they all came down to pretty much similar what you're doing, surveys where people can be questioned, not really getting the guys onto machines measuring the forces that are being created,
right? And that was another big motivator of mine, is when I started doing my literature review and seeing like yes, there is an immediate just like gap of like there's not enough research looking at adults with cerebral palsy. But then, like you're saying, Cindy, within the realm of research looking at adults with cerebral palsy, I was struck by there are certain, you know, gaps and these sort of missing aspects of the research, in my opinion. And, you know, there's some great studies that have, you know, exercise physiology, because I was looking at, you know, there are a lot of questions when you don't know about cerebral palsy, like, am I asking a question that is even worth asking? You know, are people with cerebral palsy able to generate like exercise, or is exercise? And of course, really early into my research, yes. Like, it's very clear that people who have cerebral palsy
exercise so much harder than everybody else every single day. They're all elite
athletes. Yeah. And that was the one gap that really seemed, the piece that really seemed to be missing, and where, like, I don't want to speak for anybody else, but it really seemed like these researchers who were looking at adults with cerebral palsy were really missing the plot. They were missing, like, they didn't have full comprehension over what the experience of having cerebral palsy is, or what really the challenges that exist are. They really seemed focused on taking somebody who has cerebral palsy and helping them look and feel like they weren't somebody with cerebral palsy, in a way,
removing the disability instead of embracing it, accepting it, and welcoming it.
Exactly. It seemed to be ways of trying to get it.
It's so much, I'm going to cue you vocabulary in the cerebral palsy exercise world, especially around therapy. I'm going to cue you, you know.
Right. Fix
it's
it.
Not going to happen. That cure, they're always going to have this resistance because it's a lack of nerve growth. It didn't grow. It's not there. You can't cure something that doesn't exist.
Right. There's scar tissue where the wiring was supposed to be heading out to the body. So... Yeah. You can't cure somebody. It's like somebody who is like an amputee or something and saying, well, I'm going to cure you of, like, or somebody, we're going to throw that leg back. Yeah, it's like, no, even with prosthetics, right, you're not curing them of having one leg, right? So there was sort of this, and I was struck by it because, you know, there were these studies where they were having adults, you know, sometimes it was 2-3 dozen adults coming in for a 12-week exercise regimen. And, you know, they have all of these adults who have good retention rates and are there, they're active, and they're really participating. But then the researchers look at the results, and in the discussions, you know, they barely acknowledge that their project was a success when the, you know, range of motion doesn't increase by a significant enough value, or the additional number of steps, like they try to get them to take more steps, and it's like, oh, well, they took 3 more steps after 12 weeks, which doesn't relate to a significant growth or change. And I'm looking at this and saying, wow, you got 3 dozen adults with cerebral palsy. Yeah. And for me, that's a huge success in a project, but it and they would have been able to, in my opinion, see more positive effects if they were, say, looking at the individual's quality of life during those 12-week programs, or looking at maybe just asking them about their attitudes towards being physically active. You know, at the beginning of the 12 weeks, do those individuals feel more confident, you know, getting out of their chairs or setting down their walkers or things like that, rather than just saying, oh, this study wasn't quite a success because we didn't see fitness growth.
I think with me, any little success I have, physical therapy and in life, it just like an awesome thing for me. If I'm able to put my socks on in the morning, I'm like so excited. Yeah, I got my socks on. If I'm in PT and it's been a couple of days since they used the goldiometer on me, I'm like, okay, can you get the goldiometer and measure my bend in my knee now? Even if it's 1 degree, I'm like,
that's a huge win. Yeah, no, absolutely.
When I ran exercise classes 3 days a week, every week, for about just over 12 years for people with complex needs, mainly cerebral palsy. And that's what I did, was use themselves as the baseline, because I couldn't find any baseline measurements. What's an appropriate baseline measurement for a population of people that every single one of the peoples is totally diverse and unique? Everybody's got palsy, but they, because different muscle fibers are affected, they move differently and they look different. And so I used zero, and I got them to go through a standard range of movement. Then I'd measure them again in 3 months and show them their standard range of movement and how much they improved. And it was just the most empowering measurement, because they were looking at themselves and the difference they were making in themselves.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that was like the final kind of cap on my deciding and solidifying that this was kind of the research field for me, was that was part of the limitations, the acceptance of limitations for researchers, was that it's, not to put too fine a point on it, that it's too difficult to do this research because of the very nature of cerebral palsy, in that it's a physical injury to the brain that occurs, you know, during about the last month of gestation through even the first 2 years, you're susceptible to the brain injuries that can cause cerebral palsy.
And actually, aptitoid cerebral palsy, it's in the first 12 weeks. So, you know, it just depends when that brain injury is. Yeah.
Exactly. So the brain is developing at such a rapid rate at that time that there's no way that two individuals could experience identical injuries and have an identical outcome just because of the very nature of it.
My friend Jethro, I thought that all my life, and then I meet these adult twins. You can't tell them apart. You just can't, David. You look at them. I'm going to post their picture up, because you go, how can that be possible? They were twins, though, so obviously the damage occurred at exactly the same time, but then to then progress to being an adult and still look identical.
That's interesting, yeah.
That is so crazy, yeah.
But so there's, so for me, I look at that and I think, okay, well, you know, we're here in the 21st century, we have knowledge of complex statistics, we have the computing power to do, you know, complex statistics quite quickly. And so saying that, oh, well, they're too difficult to group. And, you know, so that's why, Cindy, for you, it's great to hear somebody say, okay, well, yeah, there might not be much value in comparing one individual with cerebral palsy to another individual with cerebral palsy, but to take that person.
Statistics are great, because I can go, look, I've got a 10% increase in range across the population, or a 40% increase in range across the population, even though they're unique. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so, So taking all those factors into account and saying, okay, well, let's just look at adults with cerebral palsy and let's see what their experiences are. Let's see where their cognition is, and let's see how as a population of adults who have this positive diagnosis of having cerebral palsy, let's just see where they are all, let's see where they're all at, right? So let's say, and that's kind of where my study is kind of founded in, is saying, okay, in an able-bodied population, we as the scientists in this field know without a doubt that people who are more physically active tend to have a more smoother operating cognitive system. If you're sedentary, that makes it more difficult. Your brain needs to use up more resources to perform cognitive tasks. And that sedentary effect is both acute. If you're just sitting down watching TV, vegging out for a half an hour, your brain is not going to be functioning as well as it did before that half hour of just sitting and spacing out. So we know that, and same thing with physical activity. Actually, one of the first studies I did for my PhD was just taking regular college students and either having them be active for 30 minutes or 20 minutes or sit and do nothing. And that just acute period of time, we saw that being physically active keeps your brain functioning at the high levels that it wants to be at. Whereas if you're sedentary, your brain goes, all right, well, we're going to start shutting a few things down. And
that's automatic.
it's an automatic response. We see that in an acute level, but then we also see it at a lifestyle level. So if you look at people who tend to be more physically active versus people who tend to be more sedentary, you see a smoother and more, more comfortably operating cognitive function system. They don't need to use as many cognitive resources to perform the same tasks. And that is a fact across all ages, crib to coffin, whatever the person's lifestyle is, that is the case. And
wire together sort of.
Exactly. Yeah. I like to think about it as when you're active, it's like getting an oil change for your brain, right? You don't change the engine at all. The engine doesn't actually work better. It just doesn't have to work as hard and there's less resistance for what it wants to do, right? I'm not saying that people who are active are smarter than people who aren't active, right? That's not the case, but their brains are able to operate with less resistance.
Yes.
And so I look at this amazing population of individuals who have cerebral palsy, and their level of being physically active is incredible because you have muscles that are firing continuously without being asked to. Additionally, the cognitive load of having cerebral palsy is unimaginable unless you have it, because you have simple tasks require much more, quote, simple tasks require a complex series of planning and...
Like I mentioned, putting on socks in the morning for you guys, like 1, 2, 3, for someone like me to put on one sock. It takes me 5 minutes to put on one sock because I have to see how my leg can bend to get it over my heel or blah, XYZ.
It's a complex task when you can't rely on those postural muscles to keep you stable.
And the funny thing is, years ago when they broke my leg, they gave me a sock aid to help me, and putting the sock on the aid, it was harder than putting the sock on my foot.
Wow.
And even shoehorn, like my dad to get the shoehorn can help you, but I don't have the coordination to hold my foot in the shoe while holding it.
And also, as soon as you start putting that foot in the shoe, then all the muscles start resisting the action. And so you're getting a whole lot of compounding muscular resistance that's happening.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, right. So with this, you know, with the fact of this, Nate, with this, you know, innate part of having cerebral palsy, you know, I see that we really need to understand as a field what the experience is and where there are benefits to activity and where there might be detriments to activity. And really starting to understand what that experience is like and how we can, you know, serve that population as best as we can. Because as a field, exercise psychology and exercise physiology, the idea is to help maximize the human potential, right? We're saying the human mind and body work best when they work together. And when they're not working together, it's really difficult. And you know, cerebral palsy, I think, is a prime example of when the mind and body are not properly communicating. And to have this population where that's the case, and to have a field of science where this is, like, I feel like this is what the field of exercise psychology and where you have the conflux of neuroscience, psychology, and physical, you know, and you know, exercise physiology. When you bring all those together, it almost feels completely natural for cerebral palsy to be this, you know, prime study population of how do we combine our combined knowledge of neuroscience, human movement and kinetics, and psychology. And so I'm go ahead.
It's perfect, isn't it, really?
Yeah, because it really requires the application of all three sciences.
It does.
And more. And that's, you know, as we're entering the 21st century and moving forward, you're seeing a lot more collaboration across departments, across fields of study. So I'm really excited about that prospect. And, you know, having the chance to look at this population and say, okay, here are questions you haven't been asked before. And to, you know, ask these questions and not know what the outcome is going to be is really exciting. And so that was the big motivation when I was really putting all the different elements together with this study.
And David, I know because we talked before that I've got two things to ask, but I know that from before, you know, one of the things I like the most about your survey is that you've actually created a cerebral palsy specific way of questioning so that the disability is minimized and the person can maximize their potential in that survey. And I really like that. So I'd like you to tell the people how it is cerebral palsy specific. And the other thing I want you to show the people is how you describe cerebral palsy to your students, because I really loved that.
Yeah. So I guess I'll start with the study. So I might tease in a few of those definitions and how I like to talk about cerebral palsy. But so the study itself, I took the idea of, okay, if this was an able-bodied population, here's how we'd be asking the questions, and here's the questions we'd want to ask. And I then looked through the literature and said, okay, can we, a lot of these
What's happened?
He kind of
be able to respond in the same way, right? You're looking at, like, how many days were you active for 45 minutes or more at a time, and, you know, all these examples of activities. So I looked to the literature for various studies that looked at any measurements of physical activity in adults with disability. So I looked at studies that looked at, you know, quadriplegic adults or people who have, you know, severe spinal cord injuries, and how do we look at their amounts of physical activity, and how do we quantify their experience. And so I sent out a few emails to some of the researchers I was looking up their information for, and kind of made an amalgam of these various physical activity and disability surveys so that it could include not only how physically active the individual is, so really trying to measure every little bit of physical activity and exercise, but then also looking at their relationship with their cerebral palsy. So how impactful is their disability to their daily life and their not only their ability to perform daily tasks, but also just the mentality of having cerebral palsy and how impactful is that on your day-to-day. And then also including, and this is where there's another kind of interesting measure, is the sedentary behaviors of adults with disability. So, and the important thing with that is sedentary behavior is when you're making an active choice to do nothing. So for able-bodied people, it's, you know, sedentary behaviors could be, you know, when you're sitting at a desk working instead of at a standing desk, or if you're sitting at a desk for 4 hours at a time instead of taking, you know, 10-minute breaks. But the initial knee-jerk reaction was, well, aren't all people who have quadriplegia going to be more, just naturally seem more sedentary? But that's not the case, because I'm asking questions about specifically like making the choice to sit and take a nap during the day instead of, you know, not taking it. Or, you know, sitting and being social instead of, you know, and there are these other factors. So we really
have quite a full active life.
I would love to see a study done on people with CP and how much energy it takes to sleep at night, because there are some mornings when I wake up like starving, like
you're having so much spasticity in your sleep, but your muscles are never getting a long duration of rest. And I mean, so there's so many factors at play that I feel like are just kind of being ignored, because there are so many factors, it's easier to just say that group is really complex and complicated and to just kind of put on the tag of we don't have the methods right now. But then how do we come up with those methods? It has to be trial and error. It has to be, okay, well, let's test it
somewhere, somehow.
Exactly. And that's what my study is aiming at. We're saying, okay, here are adults with cerebral palsy. So long as they're part of the 60% of adults with cerebral palsy that have zero intellectual disability that go along with it, or at least not an intellectual disability that inhibits their IQ. So, you know, autism, that can be considered an intellectual disability, but over 60% of people...
Information process, the person with autism actually then becomes the more intelligent person.
Right, yeah. Process. Yeah, that was one thing that really struck me, is I was expecting the majority to be on the other side, just from being an able-bodied person looking from the outside into a disability population. And, you know, when you think, you know, it's a neural injury that happens, you know, in development, you know, I was under the wrong side of the impression of saying, oh, I bet that population is mostly brain damaged, when really the population is mostly intellectually normative.
Totally. And what I found, because I was actually part of, you know, because I was in the 80s and 90s getting people out of institutions and we'd build houses for them and I'd be how to be in the community.
Right.
What we found was an entire population of people who had been designated morons, and that was actually what was written on the hospital thing, morons, because you couldn't speak and you couldn't turn yourself over and you couldn't go to the toilet. You were considered to be no intelligence at all. But what I found when you got them out, the more that person was affected by cerebral palsy, the higher the potential they would have for being extremely intelligent. And listening to your exercise oils, the brain theory, you know, that just totally fits with what I found. You know, we got just over 125 people out of institutions, and we would then, I would train the staff to work with those 125, and I worked with the same 125 for 10 years. And plus other people would come in and out. Yeah, and so right. I have videos on people, some of them for 7 years, because it took me 5 or 6 years to come up with the way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But and that's fantastic.
The more intelligent, the more they are disabled, the more intelligent they're likely to be, and the more likely you can find a way of communicating.
Right. Yeah. And so the big struggle was saying, okay, so we accept that these individuals have normal intelligence. We accept that these individuals are, except for the fact that their bodies don't listen to their brains, are no different than any other able-bodied person, by and large. So how do we then get around the physical disability so that we can ask these questions and get some of these measures that where we can start to make large claims? And that was one of the bigger, so the two big hurdles were actually getting data collection. So how are we going to get in touch with adults with cerebral palsy so we can actually collect the data?
And the you second, need 100, eh? 100, yes. That's a lot of people.
Yes, yeah. So and that was due to the amount of statistical kind of coverage we were going to do. So I'm planning on comparing about 9 or 10 different variables with cognitive function and physical activity. So to have strong enough statistical power, I would need about 100 participants, and I'm at 30 right now completed, which is great. But that was one of the frustrations was, okay, so the best way to do this cognitive testing would be in person, and trying to get in-person data collection between myself and a research assistant and an adult with cerebral palsy, trying to get all three schedules coordinated and, figure out travel and everything. It wasn't working. And we kind of had that plan going in that was going to be how I did my data collection. So transferring from having a, pen and paper in-person study to being an online study took a lot of time and effort, and I really am grateful to my advisor, Dr. Matt Pontifex, who's great with programming and developing of methods. And also Piotr Pasek, who I mentioned earlier, he was my designated pilot for the study. So all the modifications we were making, all the different adjustments, we were really having him be kind of our tester for that, and our main kind of consultant because he is probably the most physically active person I know. He exercises and plays sports 6 or 7 days a week. He's a machine. But he does have quadriplegic spasticity. I mean, he, similar to you, Marie, his difficulty speaking and all of that, but
I used to be like him, and then I used to work out in the gym 4 hours a day for 5 or 7 days a week, and then
gym junkie, love it.
Yeah, caught up to me, and just because we have cerebral palsy doesn't mean that we don't get other genetic conditions, and I just happen to get psoriatic arthritis, which is not good for someone with cerebral palsy. So in the last, I would say 5 or 6 years, I have slow down because that takes a lot out of me.
Yeah,
absolutely. And so I'm really excited to be in a position where I can look at this population and more specifically look at enough individuals. I'm really excited to see how many different people and from different walks of life and from different that was one of the big benefits of doing an online study, was the variety of individuals I've been able to get data from, because it's online, you know, people, no matter where they live, can participate in the study as long as they have a computer or laptop and access to use Google Chrome or Firefox. Those are the two browsers that it works best in, just because right now, without having any funding, it's all using, you know, free access or cheap source data collection.
Say Chrome and Firefox, and we'll have the link for David's survey on the Real Life of Adults with Cerebral Palsy website and in our group as well.
Yeah, it's really quick and easy. I mean, you just enter the link, the URL, and the study immediately pops up and opens. You sign in. The consent is all there. It's all self-contained. So it goes from consent to the survey questions through to the cognitive test, all together in one window.
Can I put it on my Twitter? I started the Twitter with the same name.
Yes, I will. I'll share. I have a Twitter flyer as well as a Facebook edited flyer. I'll make sure to share those flyers. And really, the social media has been the best access for me, for participants, which has been really exciting. I tried reaching out to, you know, the United Cerebral Palsy organizations and other more higher order organizations, saying, you know, I'm a PhD student, I'm looking for adults with cerebral palsy. This is a group that you serve. Can you help me get in touch with the people you serve? And a few people said, you know, I'll pass it along. But mostly I got, you know, either no response or responses saying, you know, we're not able to help you at this time. But then, so I, after getting those responses, I, you know, went onto Facebook, typed into the group, you know, search bar, typed cerebral palsy, refined it to groups, and just said, okay, how many groups help or are of adults with cerebral palsy? And, you know, if there's any chance that I can get in touch with any of these individuals. And, you know, that's how I met each of you. Marie specifically, you know, I met Cindy through Marie.
Yeah, Marie, she's great. She's all over social media. That I met her through Facebook. So
that's how I became more aware of adults with CP, because I was running away from my cerebral palsy. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. And one day I got to a UCP meeting and I met a bunch of people, and one of the people I became friends with showed me how, if you put cerebral palsy in Facebook, you get a lot more people under more knowledge of cerebral palsy.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, absolutely. And I was really struck by that. And so I went through and just basically appealed to get into each group. So like there are a lot of groups, you know, that are, you know, only adults with cerebral palsy, or groups that are specifically for, you know, adults with cerebral palsy in certain regions. And so I just reached out to all of those different groups, introduced myself, and, you know, had to assure that I wasn't trying to sell anything or do anything for personal profit. You know, all the questions are, you know, like, do you have cerebral palsy? And I just be like, no. but I'm really grateful that so many of those groups have permitted me to be a member, and, you know, given me access to communicating with their members, because I've met some great individuals. There's actually a guy, Scott McCreet, that I sent both of your information to. He's a guy in Texas that I've had a great conversation with. And, you know, I've really gotten into contact with some fantastic individuals who either have cerebral palsy or are researchers looking into cerebral palsy. And, you know, I've just gotten phenomenal response rates and responses back.
We just got to up that to get more than 30. We want another 70 people to do the survey.
Yeah, that'd be excellent. And it's you know, a lot of individuals have either opened up the link or have filled out the survey. A lot of it comes down to that the cognitive task that games sometimes, if you're working on like Microsoft Edge or something like that, even on Firefox, sometimes it'll time out and it won't load. So we have had some technical issues with that. But Chrome, if you're using Chrome and you're on a laptop or a computer, that's really how it works best. I believe I have had a lot of people opening up the test on their mobile devices, so like on a phone or a tablet, which works great for the survey portion. So answering all the questions, tablet or mobile device is great. But then once that comes around to the cognitive test, it doesn't work on a mobile device. But yeah, Marie, what were you saying?
Instagram's also another great place.
Oh, excellent. Yes, yeah, so I'll have to check out Instagram next. Thank you.
If you just use the hashtag cerebral palsy, another great person to get in contact with, and I don't know if you have or not, her name is Jessica, and she runs the Abler. It's on Facebook, and it's, I'll text you her.
Yeah.
And stuff, you know. She's also a great resource. She's here in Connecticut, and I've known her for years.
Excellent, yeah. And that's been what has been really fascinating about this whole process is the effects of networking and how positive the feedback has been, and how it's difficult when for me being, you know, I like to joke that I'm the most hated demographic in the world right now, you know, a white heterosexual male, you know, like here I am as a 6'4" able-bodied white male coming in and you know, trying to talk about, you know, disabled populations experience or, you know, these other groups. And, you know, I'm often worried that I'm going to come in seeming like, you know, white man who thinks he knows everything. But what's been great is to have a lot of people give me the feedback of saying, you know, these are the questions people haven't been asking us. And the excitement of participation. And for me personally, I feel like that comes from being, I was ostracized a lot as a kid. I was picked on and teased and all of that. And so I feel like I have a more of an eye for people who are treated as outsiders or who are considered. Yeah, and empower them, exactly. Because I don't know how many times that, you know, people look at you or based on appearance or whatever else, they make decisions, and especially to cast a person aside or to put them into a group of other.
That whole moron thing, you know, in the institution.
Exactly.
Even when people told them that it wasn't, that there was intelligence there, and you can always see that the person can understand, you know.
Mm-hmm. I say, I like to think to myself, the package was wrapped differently than what
yes, it was
supposed to be. And even though the package is wrapped differently, the same context is in the package as it would be in the able-bodied.
Exactly.
And you know what, David? One thing that I found in my life working with people with complex needs and cerebral palsy is that their happy button is right up here. And I feel like, you know, your whole PhD, it's on is activity related to positive mental health? Well, I can tell you without a doubt that these guys who have got this hyperactive movement system, they laugh easily, they entertain amazingly, and they're just so happy. I come into this totally happy population. I mean, not everybody's happy, of course, you know, but generally...
They're more open to positivity.
Absolutely. I just totally believe that you're going to get a really positive outcome to this statistical analysis. We've just got to get the 100 people in to make sure that you can validate it.
Right, yeah. And that's... Thank you. I appreciate that. And that's been the really exciting thing, is having such positive feedback and having such... You know, again, I'm shining on a light onto a group of people who have been in darkness. And so it's really great to be like, to not have to search. You know, it's one of those things. Like, there's this group that's just been waiting, you know, from
there's knocking on that door. That's right.
Is that the people I've been contacting, you know, like, oh my gosh, I've been waiting to fill out another survey. I've been waiting to participate in more research. With able-bodied populations, if you send out an online survey, you're looking at, you know, if you're lucky, you get a 1 in 100 response rate of people who like open the link and then end up finishing it. Like a 1% or a 0.01% is pretty standard for able-bodied populations. And right now I'm sitting at probably 25 to 30 or 40% response rates. I've had over 100 people open the link, look through the consent information, and you know, out of that, I have 30 fully completed participants. So I imagine that a large group of that have filled out all of the survey questionnaires and then just not the cognitive task as well, which, combining those two, you know, factors in my data collection currently, like, I'm having just such a much higher response rate. So really the trick now is just, you know, getting, you know, another 70 people who are able to open the link and go from beginning to end.
Those cognitive tests are made for people with cerebral palsy. They are made for them. So if you want to go in and persevere, do those cognitive tests, because they minimize movement, maximize cognitive functioning.
So most cognitive tasks in my field are response time based and accuracy based. So a common study is like the Flanker study. If you look it up, it's, you know, 5 little icons, usually arrows, where 5 arrows are all pointing one way or the other, and you're focusing on that middle arrow, and for the flash that it's, you know, for the half a second or less that it's on the screen, we ask the participant to say, is that middle arrow pointing to the left or the right? And which works great. I mean, we get really robust neural responses. We can, you know, measure really great things about response time and accuracy and cognition with those. But I mean, immediately, if you know about cerebral palsy, you recognize that that task will not work.
It's such a problem with that. Focus on, I'll pick eeny, miny, moe.
There's certainly anxieties that then come up if this is an easy task, either push left or right, and then it's just anxiety ridden and nearly impossible. So there are a few of the researchers, luckily other people have, you know, again, paved the way, who developed something called an inspection time task, which instead of the time effect, instead of it being on your ability to respond, what we're looking at is your brain's ability to retain information quickly. Like, what is the peak performance of your short-term memory? So we show a simple little shape. It's like a little, like, kind of hook R with either a long leg on the left and then a little hook R, or kind of a reverse of that where the leg is long on the right and then a little hook on the left.
Like a hangman sign.
Like you're setting up a game of hangman. And then, so that plain little hangman shape is up for between 800 milliseconds, so almost a full second, to as quick as 80 milliseconds, which is, you know, very, very fast. And as soon as that hook is on there for that period of time, then a little crosshatch pattern covers up both legs so that they appear, so you can't tell which one was longer. And it's the participant's task to take as much time as they need to respond with either a left button press or a right button press to say the leg on the right was longer or the leg on the left was longer. And so what this looks at is your brain's ability to take in information very quickly and respond to that information, which is exactly the same as a Flanker task. It's just using kind of a reverse order of operations. And so far we've gotten really great responses. my hope is that everybody's able to respond really well to that. The task itself has some positive correlations to measures like intelligence, and in children, this task has been directly related to severity of disability. But even within the severity of disability, that was the key measure, was just severity of disability within youth and inspection time. So I'm looking at not just extent of disability, but activity level, sedentary behavior level, age, sex.
Totally holistic.
Yeah, totally holistic. As holistic as I could be within, of course there's the limitations of this is a doctoral dissertation project. I don't have lots of resources or funding or, a research team that I can help me with this. So it is limited, but within its limitations, I'm trying to be as broad and as inclusive as possible, which is why, if I was just looking at inspection time and disability in adults, I'd already be done with my data collection with 30. But because I want a more holistic approach and I want to be able to speak more about about adults with cerebral palsy, that's why I require such a larger sample size.
Yeah.
And like I said, I've gotten great responses. The study itself takes between 15 minutes and 45 minutes to complete. But you can take all the time you need. I have some participants who took like 4 hours because they took breaks between the surveys. It's perfectly fine. It's all self-paced. And like I said, I'm just looking to get responses, to get people who can complete from beginning to end. And if I'm able to get all my data collected before the end of the year or around January, then I'll for sure be able to get my PhD by May. Yeah,
which is... We can start pushing it so we can get those people in as fast as we can.
Yeah, which is exciting, because once I'm able to get my PhD, then I can hopefully start working in a disability research lab or get a job at a department that wants to expand its research into disability, or whatever the case might be. But I really just need to get the degree so I can start into that career of helping.
If any time you are in research and you do need help, I'm willing to help out, because that's my whole thing. I want to help out college students, PhD students.
Anyone that wants to make that knowledge of cerebral palsy grow and prosper.
And one of the things is, one of my passions is working with, and I got to try to do it more, is working with the doctors who think that sports medicine is everything. And like, I went for knee replacement. Doctor did it perfectly, textbook wise, to what he does for an everyday patient.
Mm-hmm.
But when he did it with me, he didn't realize that cerebral palsy doesn't sleep when nicely.
Right.
So, and he didn't realize, her bones are more porous than the bones I work with every day, so I should build it differently. And, he did it normally, and I wind up breaking my femur bone right in half, and they broke both sides of the femur bone.
Right, and that's such an extreme example.
Yeah,
an intense example. And I'm sure there are many more individuals like you who have had similar experiences where there's just. And that was one of and this again ties back into one of my big motivating factors, is there's just such a lack of knowledge. And for there to be such a lack of knowledge when cerebral palsy represents the largest demographic of children's disabilities. Like if you look
and across the world
across the globe, the number one physical disability in youth is cerebral palsy.
And I think people have to get that out of there. I think that good that people know that, but I think people also have to broaden their horizons. It's the largest disability population in youth, but CP doesn't go away at 18 or
exactly.
Still the largest in adults as well.
Exactly, yeah. And probably the only reason why it's not one of the largest populations of adults is there are a number of mortality issues that come up with cerebral palsy where you have, life expectancy can be anywhere between 30 and normal. And so you have this, and because of that, for me, that is another motivator for researching, is saying, okay, well, you have this population, extremely large population of children, and yet as adults, we have just this complete sea of unknown unknowns of, what are the factors that fully impact mortality? Is it severity of disability, or is it other factors? That list just grows from there.
I can tell you for a fact, one of the oldest people I've met in my life with CP is probably 90 now.
Wow, yeah. Right, and so CP can have immense impacts on life expectancy and other factors into adulthood. Early onsets of arthritis and other disease or illness or degenerative physical issues. And instead of researching that and saying, okay, well, how can we help these individuals with cerebral palsy have more fulfilling, longer lives? Instead saying, okay, well, how can we make their lives as children best? Which is obviously valuable, is obviously important. Yeah. But I can't help but see it as discrimination when you have this population where up until 18, the positive role that science and research and academia play on their lives.
Exactly.
And then to just be booted from that. It's just,
The people that are wheelchair bound every day to sitting are getting the arthritis at 17 or 18 because they don't get up off the wheelchair because they can't walk. I know my friend Jessica, who I told you about, that runs the Apler, she's wheelchair bound and she started to get arthritis at 18, 20 years old because she sits all day long.
Right.
Yeah.
Totally. Which to me, that's the group where I'm saying, okay, well, some of that behavior is sedentary, but some of it is just the nature of their disability. And we can't consider all time for somebody who is wheelchair bound. We can't consider them to spend 24 hours a day sitting, right? Because they aren't just sitting, right? They're wheelchair bound. So that's their equivalent.
They're taking forces in all these weird ways that are changing the shapes of their skeletons. Because sitting is not a natural position that our body can actually do. It has to adapt to sitting.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Precisely. And so I'm hoping that this research will be able to grow and develop and help other disability populations as well. But it's all very new to me. I did not enter my PhD with a focus on disability research. Like I said, it wasn't until after I actually finished my comprehensive exams that I learned about this deficit in cerebral palsy research. And so, I was going into my fall of planning, what am I going to do for my dissertation, having all these different study ideas. And then that fall, where I'm kind of planning what my dissertation is going to be, learning about this new group and kind of going on a year-long kind of odyssey of discovery, and you know, reading tons of studies, talking to Peter, meeting Nigel Paneth, who's an epidemiologist at Michigan State's campus, who is a big name in the epidemiology of cerebral palsy. He studied it, you know, globally, internationally. I learned a lot about cerebral palsy from him, because he, you know, as I said before, aside from knowing that it was a disability that impacted the brain and the body, like that was it. So it's just been a really great experience to not only learn about this group, but to, you know, in a lot of ways be welcomed in, and to really get that one-to-one conversation and get that kind of ground level perspective. I hope that's going to help me be a better researcher, because a lot of researchers, I mean, like you were saying, Marie, even doctors who are doing, you know, knee replacements, and, you know, who have you on the operating table, you know, you have people who are looking inside your muscles, right, inside your body, and still not understanding.
Yeah, they're like, oh my gosh, this girl's in a deep sleep, but yet her body's still, her muscles are still running around like she's running a marathon.
Right, and it's because there's scar tissue in your motor cortex that is constantly sending information. It's the way I like to think about it as an able-bodied person is the pain and discomfort when you get like those really random Charlie horse cramps.
Yeah.
Like one muscle strip in your calf tightens up and you have like this ball of pain in your leg that just like won't go away for 20 minutes until you either forget about it for long enough or it subsides.
Yeah.
And I have to imagine that. What if every time I tried to move any muscle group, there was a 90% chance of that happening, and also just a good chance that that experience is happening in different muscle groups all over my body at the same time?
I have the runaway finger, like this pinky, my pinky on my left hand doesn't like to be with everyone else, so like, at night I'll be sleeping and my pinky will be like, okay, time to run around and play. Okay, I want to sleep, but please play. I don't care, you're keeping me up all night, so I guess I'll do something.
So your left pinky will just like twitch and just like kind of throw itself out.
I learned to like keep a ball beside my bed, so if I hold the ball real tight, the pinky will go back in to me.
Yeah. I see. Yeah. You're overriding that missed signal. So you're saying, okay, instead of just my pinky, you know, misfiring, I'm going to tell all of my hands to do this coordinated movement.
Yeah.
Which is the best advice for having, how an able-bodied person can get rid of a cramp or something like that, right? You have a cramp in a specific muscle fiber in your calf. You need to flex and extend your calf.
Yep.
And do those stretches until it goes away.
Yeah.
But then I think it's difficult, right, as an able-bodied person to imagine yourself having a disability. And so for me, I just try to, you know, I try to picture that, you know, there's something I talk to my students about when I talk about flexion versus extension. And it's something I've incorporated when I talk about cerebral palsy, which is because it's so hard to get your mind around what that experience would be like. So I use the cramp analogy, which I really like, but then also the body fights against itself, right? And so there's so much cognitive effort going into movement. So one thing the example I like is like, imagine flexing your bicep, right? As hard as you can, right? Squeeze your bicep as hard as you can. And now straighten your arm out and grab, like pick up a glass of water and bring it back to your mouth while also keeping your bicep flexed as hard as it can that whole time. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I used it in my anatomy class last week, David.
Oh, you did? Oh, that's great.
I was teaching the muscular system, and I'm like, right, this is what cerebral palsy feels like.
Oh, that's excellent. Yeah, and then you just imagine, okay, now what if there was that amount of resistance where a muscle group where, you know, for all intents and purposes, you should have control over, not only isn't listening, but is actively working against you.
Oh my.
And then just imagine that for, and so people, you know, and it's easy to think about with something simple, right? Like direct extension and flexion, so what I like to say is, okay, and you realize, oh my gosh, that's so difficult. That's so much effort. And then I say, okay, now imagine that for every small muscle involved in speech or in eating. But, you know, so then it becomes, and I feel like that was a lot like how you're saying how in the hospitals people treat adults with cerebral palsy so much differently. And because we take for granted the millions of decisions your brain makes every time you form a single word, right? The millions of firings and connections that are required for smooth speech.
You know what, doctor? I hate going to the worst. And it's not that I don't like going. I hate going to the dentist.
Because you have to keep your mouth open.
When they're cleaning my teeth, I leave there, I'm like, okay, do you have all 10 fingers still on you?
Yeah. Wow. It's just so much focus to an effort.
Yep.
Wow. That makes so much sense. Yeah, and
I'm going to have to head off to work, because me it's...
Okay.
It's 8:30, your day is starting.
Correct.
Before I have to, did either of you have any other questions about my research or anything? Or I just want to make sure that I don't have any.
No, I'm pretty much. Did you read that?
I did.
Was that all right?
I think the only thing was just a few spelling.
I've made sure. Name and your University of Michigan kinesiology.
Yeah, I mean, other than that, it was just those little small details. But yeah, it's great.
Hopefully, it will assist you to get some people to do the survey. And like I say it again, people, get online, do David's survey. If you've got cerebral palsy, let's help everybody else to get a better understanding of it.
Yeah, thank you.
If you want to repost it like you posted it the first time, because it's been a while and we've done other stuff, so if you want we post
it. Yeah, I'll once I get off of here, I'll repost that onto Marie onto your Facebook groups. Okay.
Cool.
But thank you once again for a really totally interesting talk, David.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Anytime you need any help, let us know. You're always welcome in our group and stuff. So
thank you so much. I really appreciate it. I'll keep you two posted, and Marie, I'll keep you posted about the meeting that might be coming up in Michigan, if that's something. But yeah, I'll definitely keep in touch.
Yeah. Okay. See you later, guys.
See you, bye.
Yeah, bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
And me.